The following is a presentation of the Matt Talk Podcast Network.
Welcome to On the Mat. I am Kyle Klingman of the National Wrestling Hall of Fame Dan Gable Museum, joined by Andy the Penguin Hamilton. How are you on this brisk day in Iowa, Andrew?
The Penguin.
Yeah.
Explain.
Well, you like baseball.
And Penguins like baseball?
No, you like baseball, and there was a baseball player for a team you don't like that was nicknamed the Penguin.
Ron Say.
Yep. And the NCAA championships are in Pittsburgh. And you know what the hockey team is named?
Pittsburgh Penguins.
And that's where the arena is going to be. So there's your connection.
And how does that connect to me?
Because it's cold outside and you are a penguin.
But I'm inside, Kyle.
Well, you will be outside at some point.
Okay.
Hopefully it's not too cold. Hopefully you're getting through your congestion. It's that time of year. I got a little bit too. I hate this when you get that and you're plugged up a little bit because I'm just on the tail end of it. So hopefully you're feeling good. I'm feeling good because when we are on this show, we're always feeling good because this is where we want to be.
We're strong. We're focused. We're energized.
Yeah, we're all those intangibles every single time. And as we dig into our mailbag, I got to say, I'm impressed with Ray. I got to say,
I'm impressed with you, Kyle. You're a star of the 6 o'clock news last night, the 10 o'clock news last night, and morning news this morning.
Let's just make sure we clarify that's local news. This isn't like the Today Show or anything.
Well, I saw it on NBC, so it was NBC news.
Okay. It was our NBC affiliate. So thank you. Yeah, we're in the midst of our Gable Museum renovation and excited about what this is going to look like and glad that there's some momentum going into this and excited that we get to partner with Track on a variety of projects that we've discussed. And I think we're dreaming up some ideas and excited about what that could be. And the new wrestling room is going to facilitate a lot of those ideas.
It's going to be awesome.
Let's go to you.
Really looking forward to it.
Yeah, I am too. And I think with technology and upgrades, it's only going to make our Hall of Fame weekend better. If you want to come to the grand opening, it is going to be on Thursday, March 28th. It's before a tournament that you are familiar with. USA Wrestling Folkstyle Nationals is the 29th through the 31st. So if you're in town and you want to stop by, we're going to kick everything off that weekend. So a great time to stop by the Gable Museum and see what the new facility looks like. You going to stop by?
I am.
Okay. Because our show is going to be there eventually. We're going to have it at the Gable Museum. We can't do it there right now because of the noise and everything there. But if you're a listener, once we get it there, you're going to have this podcast live from the Gable Museum.
I can't wait.
Can't wait either. Can't wait to get to Ray, and he got the question that I didn't think anyone was going to get. It sounds like he was born in 95, and the correct answer was 1994 NCAA championships at 158 pounds. Pat Smith was a four-timer. Joe Williams got seventh. He was an eventual three-timer. You had Marcus Mollica was a two-timer, eventual two-timer. And then Barry Weldon, I thought this was going to be the one that threw everyone. He went 0-2 in the tournament. He eventually won the NCAA championships. He was the 10th NCAA championship. So congratulations to Ray. I think it's Isalis. Sorry if I mispronounced that, but you win the prize packets. Just email Andy. Make sure you get the address to us so that we can send this out to you. And I didn't think anyone was going to get this, to be honest with you.
To clarify, the question was, which weight class had the most NCAA titles in history?
Right. Eventual, not in that particular tournament. So Joe Williams had zero at that point. Pat Smith had just won his fourth. Mollica had won one, I believe, up to that point. So it was titles. So there were 10 in that weight class. If someone can find more than that, please let us know. But I don't think there's more than 10 titles in one weight class. So,
good question. You got a question for us this week, Kyle?
I do. I have a question for us. Let's start with, if we're looking at the depth of weight classes, and we can go long term on this question, what's the best year of individual NCAA champions? So if you start at 125 across the board to heavyweight, what's the best year? What's the most prolific year of individual NCAA championships? I have a year in mind. I'm going to make my claim for 1983. I think there's enough that warrants that being the best collection of NCAA champions across the board. And I can give my rationale now or later. I don't know if you have any thoughts, but I would like that to really sink in for people. And if you have yours, I'm going to explain, let's say on next episode, because we have some other topics we want to get to, but I'm going to explain
that. You're going to say 83.
I'm going to say 1983.
Okay.
Yep. I will explain that on next week's podcast, why that is. So if someone wants to challenge me on that,
I'm going to go 2012.
You're going 2012 already?
Just like on the spot. Okay. You're throwing 83 at me. And let's run through them.
Okay.
Quick.
You want to go 83 first?
Yeah.
Okay. So we'll start at 118. Adam Questis from Cal State Bakersfield, 7 seed. Doesn't give me a lot of credibility right off the bat. But as you go up the line, Barry Davis, 3-time NCAA champion who makes an Olympic team the following year, ends up being a 3-time world and Olympic medalist. 134, Claire Anderson, who we were talking about in that 1981 NCAA championship bracket, which I thought was one of the toughest ones. He transferred to Oklahoma State. He wins the championship that year. Get into 142, Daryl Burley. I think he's underrated. 4-time NCAA championship finalist, 2-time champ from Lehigh. He won a title at 142 after redshirting in 1982. Nate Carr, I think this may be the best finals rivalry in the history of the NCAA championship. Nate Carr and Kenny Monday. Kenny Monday becomes an Olympic gold medalist in 1988, wins the NCAA championships the next year. Nate Carr, a 3-timer Olympic bronze medalist. I think you can argue that's the best finals that we've ever had. It happened twice. 158, Jimmy Zaleski, 3-time NCAA champion, arguably the greatest wrestler of the 1980s, won 89 matches in a row to end his career. 167, Mike Sheets makes the Olympic trials finals against Mark Schultz, who happens to be the 177 pounder in this, who wins an NCAA championship that year, an Olympic gold medalist the following year. Ed Bannick, a 3-timer. Mark Schultz was a 3-timer. Ed Bannick, a 3-timer. And then Lou Bannick was also a 2-timer, an Olympic gold medalist. So you end with 3 Olympic gold medalists. That's my number one.
That's pretty good. That's pretty good.
Top that. Sounds like you're going to try.
I'm going to look at it here.
Okay.
When you look at 2012, I think, I don't know, 2012 is better, but I think it's in the ballpark. Matt McDonough.
Okay.
2-time NCAA champion, 3-time finalist. Logan Stieber, 4-time NCAA champion, world champion. Kellen Russell, 2-time NCAA champion, 4-time Big Ten champion. Frank Molinaro, Olympic 5th place finisher.
Yep.
Kyle Dake, 4-time NCAA champion, world champion. David Taylor, 4-time NCAA finalist, 2-time NCAA champion, 2-time Hodge Trophy winner, world champion. Ed Ruth, 3-time NCAA champion. Steve Bozak, Cam Simaz, Tony Nelson, 2-time NCAA champion, 3-time NCAA finalist.
You got some studs there.
Yeah.
You got some studs there.
It's not completely written yet. Molinaro making a comeback. I shouldn't say making a comeback, but Molinaro's back, going back down to 65 kilos. Kyle Dake, David Taylor trying to double up on world championships this year.
You're right. It's not written by any means. So you could, 2012, when you go through the credentials, I think half still have careers ahead of them and going through at least the 2020 cycle. So history yet to be written. So let's put that one on hold.
Maybe not, quite on par with 83, but off the top of my head, that's not too bad, huh?
It could be. It could be on par if they win Olympic titles and get in the mix. So I think that's a really good one to examine. So again, if someone has another weight class they want to chime in with, please let us know. But before we get to our guest, which happens to be Big 12 Commissioner Bob Bowlesby, we're going to talk to him about a variety of interesting topics. this week's question of the week is, how long does it take to get good? And as it pertains to the sport of wrestling, I've been fascinated by this topic because organically I've heard people say, hey, it took me 10 years to get good at whatever their endeavor happened to be, whether it was business, whether it was wrestling, whether it was another sport. Across the board, I've heard 10 years. Now, in qualifying that, I had heard this from Bill Zadik as well, who happens to be the USA Wrestling national team coach for freestyle. He had said it's 10 years of elite level training in a row. So it's not just 10 years and you're just kind of hanging out and you're feeling your way through and then all of a sudden you get good. It's 10 years of very deliberate, insightful type of thinking and practice in order to get to that level. And as we think about that and where we are in the scope of wrestling, these athletes are getting good a lot quicker than they ever have because of training environments, because of tournaments. And I think because of the youth movement, which we've talked numerous times about, I think these guys are getting good way quicker because of that high level of competition way, way earlier than it ever has been.
Yeah, they're exposed to so much more now, so much more technique that they can watch at their fingertips online, matches they can watch with the best guys in the world. We've talked about this in the past. Remember like Satyev, where we talked about you might be lucky if you see Satyev one match every 4 years at the Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
And last year, Petrushvili, 2017, I bet we had 20 matches of Petrushvili on our platform with Euros, seniors and U23s and world championships, seniors and U23s and World Cup and things of that nature. So you got so much more at your fingertips now. Got the regional training centers have accelerated everything. I remember Doug Schwab telling me when he had stepped into the Iowa room, he might have been in like had like maybe less than five college level workouts that he had gone through. Now kids are coming in with like 100, 150, 200 college level workouts under their belt. Think of how much, like just look at how many true freshmen we've had as national champions here in the last 5 years. It's been incredible. So I think what we're seeing is that timetable, everything's getting moved up, and maybe the longevity of careers isn't what it once was. I mean, we've had Bill Zadik on as a guest. He won a world title, won his first world title at 33. Yeah. I don't think we're going to see a story like that maybe ever again in our lifetime, where somebody doesn't break onto the scene and win a world title until 33. But, you know, we saw our first world champion at age 19 in 2015. And I think that that's going to be closer to the norm than somebody winning on the back half of their career for the first time.
And I think that's why it can be difficult at times, because especially with wrestling, it's hard to play for the long game because it does take that learning curve to get to that point. And guys are getting better quicker because they're in that elite environment a lot quicker. I mean, and I think the regional training centers is an example, because you have high school kids working out side by side with high-level senior competition. And if you're telling me Doug Schwab had only had five high-level college practices, what'd you say, going into college?
Yeah, if that, maybe. It might not even been that many.
If that. And look at, he graduated in 2001, and then he made the 2008 Olympic team. And he kept getting better and better and better. I think he made the 07 World Championship team and then 08. But he had a learning curve he had to go through. So if you talk about that, he won his first NCAA championship in 99, started in 98. There's your 10 years. If you're looking at deliberate high-level competition, it took him 10 years to get to that point. Even with you, I think you've said in the past where, hey, look at your learning curve and how you got to that point. How long did it take you to finally understand the inner workings of, here's how the press works, here's what I need to do? It's repetition and time after time after time. And then you cross a threshold and then you're able to understand it conceptually in a way you didn't before.
I think back to like some of the things that had happened in my career. And one of the things that was most beneficial for me was one class I had in college. I learned more in one class, news editorial problems, with Steve Bloom than I probably did in all of my other classes combined that put me on the path to where I got on as a journalist. And so I think probably some of these athletes getting around just the right coach for them accelerates their learning curve. And I keep going back to the regional training center, and that was the game changer for the United States. Think about where we were as a country on the international scene in 2008 after the Olympics in Beijing and the summit, right, out at Colorado Springs, where they get all the minds together and try to figure out what's wrong here and how do we fix things. Guys are going off. The best guys are going off and competing in the octagon. How do we keep the best guys competing in wrestling? And that's where the regional training center was kind of born. It was Zeke Jones's idea, and USA Wrestling took it and ran with it. Instead of everybody trying to get everybody out to Colorado Springs, which wasn't a realistic idea at the time, it's like, how do we take Colorado Springs and take it all the way around the country and get the best coaches working with not just their post-grads, but also their post-grads training with high school kids around the area and kind of mimicking what the training scenario looks like over in Russia to a certain degree. And everything that the United States is accomplishing now can be traced back to the regional training center, the advent of the regional training center.
And as Jay Jaggers, who is one of the coaches at the Ohio RTC, he put it, you can have a training environment where you have a three-man round robin, and you can have a high school kid, you can have a current college student, and you can have a Logan Stieber who's graduated, a world champion, all training in the same round robin at the same time. And when you think about that environment, I know I never would have ever experienced anything remote to that in high school. That just even the thought of that, if as a cross-country runner, having a world-class runner training with you and you get to see that high bar, you have to get good because you're seeing what the best looks like. And when you look at Aaron Brooks right now, look at who he trains with daily. He was out at the World Cup. He was training with the high level guys. So he sees it. He's part of the program. He experiences it. So you can really expedite that process. But what's the window after you get good? And I think we want to get these guys good earlier. But when you're 20, like you said, you probably don't have that window to go into your 30s if you're doing things the right way.
Well, development and progress isn't always linear either, and it happens at different paces and different times for all of us. And that's why you see some guys on our world team last year, for example, like David Taylor and Kyle Dake. They were winners for a long, long time. Jordan Burroughs didn't qualify for the state tournament as a high school freshman. Didn't win his first state title until he was a senior, was like 16 and 13 his freshman year at Nebraska. And then everything started to click after that, and it really took off for him. I think probably about 2009 is where he really got on a roll. And I think back to the Olympic team in 2016, Daniel Dennis, same type of deal. Didn't qualify for the Illinois state meet as a high school freshman. Started to figure it out as a sophomore, never won a high school state title, never won an NCAA title, but chipped away at it and losing record as a true freshman at Iowa. So it doesn't happen at the same pace for everybody. I think back to story, one of my first years covering high school wrestling at the Iowa City Press Citizen, Terry Vesey from Davenport Assumption got cut from the freshman basketball team, turns around, goes out for wrestling, and wins a state title as a sophomore. He was an exceptional athlete, so that allowed him to come along a little bit faster. He was in an environment there where Davenport Assumption was one of the best programs in the country at the time, and things just took off for him. Yeah. Other guys chip away and chip away and chip away, and it takes a little bit longer.
Yeah. Lee Camp goes out his ninth grade year, and then 5 years later, he's beating Gable at the Northern Open when Gable makes his comeback. I mean, how could you predict that? But His learning curve was pretty fast and got to that level. But as you look at the Doug Schwab example, because I think this is a great example of what we're talking about, It took him, he's a plotter. He's a guy that it's just going to take incremental growth to get to that point. And I can remember vividly seeing him in the airport in 2007. And I said, what is he doing hanging on this long? He's never going to make it. And then what'd he do? He made the world team that year and then made the Olympic team the next year. So you don't know when your moment's going to come, but Doug kept with the system, was in the right environment, and then it ended up paying off for him with a world and Olympic team.
Well, look at Bill Zadig, too. I mean, how many people thought his career was over after Indianapolis in the Olympic trials in 04?
I was one of them. For sure was one of them. I didn't see... And everyone thought he was that. I think what's Bill's comment? I think everyone thought I was washed up at least three times by the time I won a world championship. And yeah, after 04, you just wonder how can he stick with it? But I think one of the things that he did was he got serious. He went out to Colorado Springs and eliminated all the distractions and got focused on wrestling, went under Terry Brands. And that's how he got to that level, was he just eliminated everything in his life that didn't involve wrestling. And you have to have laser beam focus to get to that world championship level. And it paid off for Bill. And now he's implementing those lessons that he learned into the USA wrestling system.
And he was coaching at the time at Iowa, four. And I, we're just not seeing that anymore. Not a lot, at least.
Great topic of conversation. We're going to have more good insight from our guest today. Bob Bowlsby, the Big 12 commissioner, is coming up. What do you say we get to a guy that you've known pretty well over the years? What do you remember about Bob being at the Press Citizen?
Remember a guy that's made a lot of pivotal decisions for the University of Iowa. You think about what he did there. A lot of gutsy decisions. Brought in Kirk Ferentz. It's pretty incredible when you hire a football coach and he's still there 20 years later and he becomes the school's all-time leader in victories. That was a heck of a hire, and that was not the popular hire, consensus popular hire across the board at the time. Turned out to be a really good one. He's made some gutsy moves. I mean, how many athletic directors would fire a wrestling coach with three national titles? Coming off the kind of success that Jim Zaleski had. 9 seasons, 8 of them in the top 4 nationally. And tough. He's an alma mater, popular guy, and he lets him go. That was a gutsy, gutsy move.
We'll get to Bob Bowlsby. Our guest today has a rich history in the state of Iowa. He went to Waterloo West High School, wrestled under legendary head wrestling coach Bob Siddons. Then he went to the University of Northern Iowa as assistant athletic director for facilities. And then get this, he becomes the athletic director at Northern Iowa, University of Iowa, Stanford. And now he is in the position of commissioner of the Big 12. Bob Bowlsby, how are you?
I'm great, guys. Good to be with you.
Well, when I go through that progression and we think about Bob Siddons, your high school wrestling coach who passed, of course, he coached 11 state championship teams in his 27 seasons and was Gable's head wrestling coach too. When you think about Bob Siddons and where you are, how much influence did he have?
Well, I had honestly, 2018 was a tough year for me because I lost my dad at age 89, and I lost Coach Siddons about 3 months later. And so they both had good long lives, but in terms of men that have had an impact on my life, those are the two principal ones. And, Coach Siddons, he imparted lessons that I think I'm not the only one that uses every day. He talks about you not taking the back seat to an opponent, not being feeling hard and doing the things that are necessary, commitment to the team and to helping everybody get better. I mean, they're lessons that you can apply in every walk of life. And, I think Coach Siddons had a profound impact on my life, not only when he was coaching me, but while I was a college wrestler and after that, but throughout my life as well. We have remained close and been, it was a different relationship as an adult going back and having Coach Siddons as a friend and mentor. And it's different than having him be your coach as a as a 16, 17, 18 year old. So I knew him both as a young guy, where he had a profound impact on my life and on my competitive career. But I also knew him as an adult, where the way he treated people and the way he went about his business was an influence in how I learned to do those things as well.
One of the things that I respected with you was that when you would come back to Waterloo, you would grab your dad, grab Bob Siddons, you'd come down to the Gable Museum. Why was it important to make sure you kept that relationship going strong, and that it was that important to you to have your high school wrestling coach that you would go pick up and actually do stuff with?
Yeah, well, I mean, to my previous comment, I mean, we became adult friends afterwards, and, you know, I tried to always call him on his birthday, and Don Huff always did a great job of making sure that there was some sort of luncheon or celebration on his birthday. And I oftentimes was, you know, I was in California or I was in Texas and I couldn't get back, especially the last few years. And so Don always encouraged me to call in and just say hello to Coach. And I know I wasn't the only one. There were lots of guys that were not getting back that wanted to wish him well. And, you know, he was so vibrant and so full of life. I mean, he was still swimming three times a week, up to a couple of years ago. And so, you know, it was always fun to come back, because he was a magnet. I mean, whenever you'd get together with Coach, it was always, you know, there were other assistant coaches there. There were other wrestlers from a wide variety of places, and it was always a reunion. And so whether it was coming to the museum or going to lunch with him or celebrating his birthday, Coach Siddons was a guy that always drew a crowd just because of the kind of person he was.
Waterloo, Iowa during that era was winning state championships left and right, whether it was east or west. What was the wrestling culture like growing up in Waterloo?
Well, it was important. And I got started wrestling at the YMCA, and you know, that was the first place that I ever competed against anybody that was different than me. You know, I knew there were African American kids that lived across the river, but I didn't really know any of them personally, and didn't compete against any of them until, you know, I got later in grade school and began to wrestle a little bit. And then the relationships that you make over the course of time, you know, those guys became good friends, but they were also, we were great competitors. I happened to have been involved my senior year in the unfortunate East-West wrestling meet that ended in a brawl, and with Coach Siddons getting hit over the head with a chair. And it certainly wasn't Waterloo's finest hour, but it was indicative of how important wrestling was. The East-West meets, the West Cedar Falls meet, the East Cedar Falls meet, those were big meets. There would be 3,000 people there, and they were important. They were covered by the media. They were embraced by the fans, and they were, you know, it was brothers that have competed against other brothers for years. You know, Dave Natvig was a Hall of Fame coach at East Waterloo, and Keith Young at Cedar Falls, and Bob Siddons at West. And these guys were as good at their craft as anybody that was out there. And the athletes that they coached were equally as good. And there were lots of state champions and lots of guys that went on to great college careers that wrestled in those three programs. And of course, we always thought we were the best at West, but likewise, the East guys and the Cedar Falls guys had their claims to lots of high achievement as well.
Bob, I've got a two-part question for you. Number one, what was it like watching the Gable story unfold in front of your very eyes there during your teenage years? And then also, fast forward about 30 years, what was it like being Dan's boss?
Well, you know, all of us aspired to be like Dan Gable. He was 4 years ahead of me in school, and I can remember going up as a junior high kid and also seeing him at the YMCA. And, you know, he was the guy that everybody aspired to, not only from a competition standpoint and an achievement standpoint, but from a work ethic standpoint. I mean, he would train with anybody. He was always very gracious to young guys trying to learn to do what he did. But he was always, more than anything else, he was a role model. And you know, as anybody who knows him or knew him in those days, I mean, Dan wasn't exactly Mr. Social during the time he was competing. He was very focused, and of course had the terrible tragedy of his sister's death, and he was all business. And as long as you were willing to be all business too, he would help you and serve as a mentor. And so, you know, everybody that was my era at Waterloo West was they considered Dan Gable a god, and that continued through his days at Iowa State and through his Olympic career. And I remember so vividly when I was the year he lost in the NCAA tournament. I was with a bunch of friends and wrestlers, and we were all just in shock. It was like, that can't be. There's no way he lost. It couldn't be that he lost. And yet he took that defeat and made it into something that was probably even greater than he would have achieved otherwise. And the way he went through the Olympic Games, obviously, is really unparalleled, unscored upon. And he enjoys a heroic profile in the Olympic world even to this day. You go to the World Championships or you go to the Olympics, and nobody ever found a way to beat Dan Gable. And then they all know also that he became a great coach. And there aren't very many great athletes that become great coaches that are able to make the transition that Dan Gable made. And I think that, for a guy that had the relationship I had with him early in my life, to then end up at Iowa and have him be the kind of coach that he was really a lot of fun. We had a special relationship, and I think, frankly, I had been the chair of the NCAA wrestling committee when I was at Northern Iowa, and I think my relationship with Dan Gable and with wrestling helped me greatly in getting the Iowa job. And I think that it obviously Hayden Fry and Tom Davis and Bump Elliott and others had a role in my getting that job. But I think nobody probably had more impact than Dan Gable, because at that time he was the head of the most successful program that the university had. And so our relationship continued and grew. And even at the time when he decided he wanted to retire and become, we created an assistant athletic director position for him. And we have had a great relationship throughout all of that time and continue to this day. Our kids all went to high school together, and our families are very close and have known each other a long time. And so those Waterloo roots have turned into a much broader relationship, and our kids are all Facebook friends, and they stay in touch with one another. It's been a lifelong relationship that has really been extraordinary. And of course I was very fond of Mac and Katie Gable, Dan's parents, and my parents were close to them as well. And my brother John, of course, was one of Dan's closest proteges when he was a wrestler. So our families are very close, and we continue to enjoy a terrific relationship. And Dan has had even as an adult, his work ethic and his commitment to excellence has always been something that anybody around him was going to be impressed by. There's only one Dan Gable, and people in wrestling recognize it, but so do people in other sports. You very seldom run into a great athlete who hasn't at least done a little bit of research on how Dan Gable became so good.
As the athletic director, you alluded to this, you have possibly the greatest athlete and coach ever. He approaches you and says, I am thinking about retiring. This is when he's 47, 48 years old. A lot of coaches don't get their first head coaching job until that point. What is your play? How do you view that? How do you say, I want to keep him around, but want to be sensitive to his situation? Take us through those steps when he approaches you.
Well, the first thing I said is, please don't do it. Please keep coaching. You're too good at it. We need you too much. And yet, in fairness to him, he was starting to have some health problems, and he was getting to the point where he had just pushed himself for so long, and he had was starting to, you know, have hip problems and back problems and knee problems, and so there were some really good reasons why he was contemplating doing what he was doing. And so, you know, I had to be respectful of that as well. And then when we got to the point where we all agreed that the transition was going to take place, then we went about the process of deciding how it was going to take place. And obviously, Coach Gable wanted the replacement to stay in the family, and that was in our best interests in order to do that as well. So he worked with me hand in hand with the replacement and the transition and what his role was going to be going forward. So, you know, it was a collaboration. It was in my estimation, and I suppose in his as well, it came too soon. He was at the very best point in his career, and yet him to kind of continue to do it the way he had done it previously. And so, you know, it was a difficult transition, and we got through it, and we found meaningful things for him to do within the athletics program. And you know, one of them was to be an ambassador to a very high level for not only wrestling at the University of Iowa, but wrestling throughout the world. And he spent a lot of time since then on trying to strengthen wrestling and trying to start new programs and keep programs from being discontinued and trying to do things to make better wrestling better at the international level and in the collegiate ranks and the high school ranks. And so, I mean, he really has been, an elder statesman for the sport of wrestling. And you can't do that unless you enjoy an iconic status like he enjoys. So, I guess if you ask what was the first thing I did, the first thing I did was I tried to talk him out of retiring. But beyond that, once it became apparent that that was going to be required, then we collaborated and worked together to try and envision what the future would look like.
Dan Gable's replacement was Jim Zaleski, who you eventually had to let go. Was that a difficult decision when you had to let Jimmy go?
Well, anytime you make a personnel change, it's difficult, especially when it's a three-time NCAA champion and somebody that I had known since high school. I actually refereed a lot of his matches when he was at Cedar Rapids Prairie, and so it was a very difficult transition and one that we didn't rush into. But, the program had declined somewhat. I think it would be difficult to assert that it hadn't. But those things are always tremendously difficult. And I like Jim Zaleski and his family a lot. And I'm glad that he's landed on his feet at Oregon State, and he's done a good job there. And it was a very difficult time and a difficult process.
Was Tom Brands your only choice?
Well, I had great affection for Tom, and he had been on the staff, and he had been a finalist for the position when Jim was hired, I think there again, we had an awful lot of good people that had come through the program that had chosen coaching as their profession. You know, you had Barry Davis out there, you had Tom Ryan out there, you had Kevin Dresser doing a good job in the high school ranks. There were there were a lot of people that could have laid claim to it. And but it, I liked Tom a lot. I liked his passion. I like his approach to building the team and managing the team. And so we felt like it was a good opportunity for us and a good opportunity for him.
Were you aware of that domino effect that happened when Russ Helixson was out at Ohio State and then everything kind of fell into place? Was that on your radar when that all transpired?
Well, it's a, you know, that's a, it's a fairly small circle in wrestling. And so you hear those things, but you never know exactly what's going to happen. And I don't think you can spend a lot of time guessing at it. I think you have to deal with what you see in front of you and what you know to be factual at the time. So, we all were hearing things about that, it wasn't absolutely certain that what was going to happen.
As far as progress for the sport, you get to see a side that we don't, and we hear a lot of things. We hear that we need to go to a one semester sport, and then we need to change the season, and we need to tweak some things, have dual meet championship. You have an administrative role. What do we need to do in the sport to get this right and to make it the best product possible?
Well, I don't think putting the best product out and doing the best thing for the sport may be necessarily 100% the same. There are those who would say, well, having it be a one semester sport would be a good thing. Well, it's arguable that having it be a two semester sport gives a longer period of competition and maybe does some things competitively that are desirable. But on the other hand, wrestling has one of the lowest graduation rates in all of NCAA sports. And so that being the case, does it make sense to have competition in one semester and not in the other? There can be a case made that athletes in general and perhaps wrestlers in specific do better during their season than during the off season from an academic standpoint. So, there are, I will say this, I think wrestling has been slow to change. I think it has at times been its own worst enemy. Right now we still have some of the prominent programs around the country that are more concerned about their own individual programs than they are about the health of wrestling overall. We have quibbled with one another over how things should be managed and what kinds of things we should do. An example of that is, we haven't always gotten the best teams to participate in the national duels. It can't be anything but a positive thing for the best teams to compete against each other on a dual meet basis. In fact, that probably is a better product to promote for fans that are not avid wrestling fans, just because there's a team identification more than the individual identification like there is at the NCAA championships. And I've long thought a national dual meet tournament would be a good idea, because I think it would bring people to wrestling that wouldn't get there watching the individual tournament. Now, having said that, I've run the NCAA tournament as the chair of the committee, and I think it's the greatest sporting event there is. But if you don't understand it and if you haven't grown up in it, it's a very difficult thing to access. And, there's about 8,000 to 10,000 people that travel wherever that tournament is. And then it's, fans from the individual schools. But I've always thought that there were some things we could do in wrestling that would better promote the sport. They're the average fan that watches it on TV and tries to get interested. They don't understand the components of stalling. They don't understand why you get penalized sometimes and you don't get penalized the other. They don't understand what constitutes a warning and what doesn't. The simpler I think we can make the sport, the more fan friendly we can make it, the better off we'll be. And now, having said all that, we don't want to do things that diminish the sport and diminish the things that we all love about it. The, you know, the physicality, the training, you know, that's one of the complaints I have about international wrestling is I think we've taken all the conditioning out of international wrestling. It's predominantly wrestled on the feet at this point. And, you know, I just think that, the Dan Gable model of training for international wrestling is in many ways gone because the physical conditioning components of it are just greatly diminished. And I think that, you know, we've made it harder to understand instead of easier to understand. So, you know, I think that you need to be thoughtful. You need to adhere to the traditions that we all love, but you also have to be flexible enough that you are responsive to the things that are going to draw fans and keep the sport strong and keep it from going away. I mean, we're very close to having no college wrestling programs in the Western United States. And there are a number of really good states, California being one of them, with very strong high school wrestling. But, you know, it isn't too much of a leap to see many of the programs in the West gone one of these first days. And so we need to be thoughtful about it. That's one of the reasons why we took in the affiliate members in the Big 12, because we felt like it was a way to have better competition within our league, but also a way to keep wrestling strong in the West.
You covered a lot of ground there, Bob. Great stuff. But you know, I was going to ask you, what do you think is the greatest thing we have going for us right now as a sport? And what do you think is our biggest challenge?
Well, I think the greatest thing we have going for it is the devotion of the coaches and the athletes. Wrestling is a tough sport. There isn't any way to sugarcoat it. You can't cheat. You can't cheat anybody but yourself if you don't invest the time and do the work. And when you're out there all by yourself, mano a mano, if you haven't done the work, you're going to have to own the consequences. And I think that self-reliance and that tradition of individuality and the ruggedness that goes along with it. I just think it teaches lessons that are very difficult to learn any other way. And I think equally coaches are very devoted to it. On the other hand, I think that, you know, the biggest challenge we have is it's a really hard sport. There aren't as many kids out as there used to be because it's hard. It's, you know, they don't want to spend the time and they don't want to spend the effort and they don't want to be out there relying only on their own initiative and their own intestinal fortitude. And so nationally, it continues to be one of the most popular sports at the high school level. But, you know, the wrestling numbers at the collegiate level have been static for a long time, and we've added a few programs, we've lost a few programs, but generally speaking, it's not in a growth mode. And so I think, you know, all of those things are challenges to the sport. I also think, pursuant to the comments I made earlier, I think there are some things that the average casual fan that might like to be a friend of wrestling, might like to be a fan of wrestling. I think there are things in our rules, and I think there are things in the way we conduct our competitions that are not particularly fan friendly. Now they may be good for the guy who, like me, wrestled 40 years ago and wants the rules to be just the same as they've always been. On the other hand, there are those who say, I don't get it. I don't understand it. I didn't live it. I don't love it. I wish the sport was a little bit different and a little bit easier to consume.
Looking at the Big 12, how hard was it to get those affiliate members to come together and get the Big 12 conference. Because for those who don't know, we were down to four teams in the Big 12 to get the additional eight. How difficult was it to make that happen?
It really wasn't difficult at all. We got to 10 right away. And then after the after we were up and running, Northern Iowa came in. And I'm trying to think who the other one was we added just a year ago. But we got to 12 eventually. And you know, I think it's a better tournament for the West Virginia, Iowa State, Oklahoma, and Oklahoma State. It feels like a qualifying tournament. The teams we added, as an example, North Dakota State had the outstanding wrestler in the tournament 2 years ago. And so I think they've been representative. Fresno State came in a year ago, and I think that's been good. And frankly, it was fun for me to add Northern Iowa and Fresno because with Doug Schwab at Northern Iowa, I've known him since he was a very young man, and Troy Steiner, of course, wrestled for us when I was at Iowa, and so. That's fun to see those guys prospering and to be able to do something to help them. But, we now have a tournament that is both good for the Big 12 and good for wrestling. You know, how long would Utah Valley have, wrestling if they didn't have a meaningful place to go and compete for a postseason spot? So, that's what I feel best about it is that we've been able to do something that's good for the Big 12. And we've been able to do something that's good for wrestling overall. And we had willing participants. And I don't know where we'll go from here. I suppose it's possible that we could get larger at some point in time. But it's a pretty strong alliance right now, and I'm proud of the fact that we've been able to do some things that help us and also help wrestling.
When you talk to other administrators, whether it's athletic directors or commissioners, what do they say about the sport of wrestling if they don't know the sport of wrestling intimately? You talked about that earlier, but what's their commentary? What do they say about the sport?
Well, you know, the challenge for wrestling is today what it's always been. There's no female counterpart sport. I mean, there is women's wrestling, of course, but not very many have it. But, you know, when you start talking about, what is your 16 sport program look like in Division One? Well, for many, wrestling wouldn't even be on the radar screen because they can't add a men's sport without adding at least one and probably more women's sports. And so, that in itself is problematic. And I think it's among the most difficult components of wrestling's current state of affairs. It's hard to imagine anybody having the resources to say, well, I really want to start wrestling, and oh, by the way, I'm going to start beach volleyball and women's equestrian in order to be able to do it. And I think that's always going to be a challenge. Now, you know, when you think about adding men's and women's cross country, it's a little easier to think about that. You don't have a lot of facilities involved. You've got lots of programs that are feeders, and you know, it's an easier decision. And so I think that therein lies the impediment to the growth in the number of wrestling programs. And I think that's going to continue to be an impediment going forward.
Have you ever thought about how connected you are? I mean, there's probably not anyone in this sport that you don't have a connection to.
Well, I will tell you this. I know some true crazies in the sport of wrestling. And I also know some of the most influential and hardworking and devoted people that I've ever encountered. There's the old adage in athletic administration, you know, you can always tell a coach, but you can't tell them very much. That's really true with wrestling coaches. They, you know, they're they're tough guys. They believe in themselves, and so convincing them to believe something else is really tough. And yet, you know, I'm one of them. I love them. I love being around them. I love training with them. I love coaching with them. It's a sport that I have very deep roots and as you said, very many connections with wrestlers, with coaches, with former coaches, with officials. You know, I refereed for 10 years and only stopped when I began as the AD at Northern Iowa because I just didn't have time for it. But I loved officiating. I loved staying close to the sport, and I coached it for a couple of years and wrestled for a lot of years. And I, you know, when people ask me what I did in college, I'm proud to tell them I was a wrestler. And I'm also glad that they look at me like, yeah, maybe I won't mess around with you since I now know you were a wrestler. You know, it's a source of great pride for me. And it's a source of many, many relationships that I have both prospered from and really enjoyed.
When you look back, we talk about wrestlers and what their impact is. What will Jay Robinson's legacy be in our sport?
You know, he's one of the great technicians and great teachers in all of wrestling. I just think he had a big impact on the Iowa program, obviously. A huge impact on wrestling in general as the head coach of Minnesota. He had really good teams there. And I like Jay a lot. He has made his mark on the sport of wrestling. And I felt bad that his health has been rough lately and that he's really been through some difficult times, but Jay was a real innovator, and he always pushed the envelope. Sometimes he pushed it in ways that didn't make me happy as his boss for part of the time. But Jay is a good friend and a great influencer in the sport of wrestling.
All right, you got to give us your take. Do you like the current FBS championship format with four teams?
Well, you know, I could capably argue either side of it. We were in it this year and the Big Ten and the Pac-12 were left out of it. And it's hard to be left out. We've been left out before and it's hard to be left out, but I like it. I think it's far superior to any model we've ever had before. It enjoys 80% plus approval rating with the American public, and you almost never find anything that's that way in this day and age. And so I think that it's there's a lot that's right about it. There were some things we wanted to make sure we took into account. We wanted to keep the regular season strong. We wanted to strengthen September and get more intersectional contests, and we wanted to keep the postseason strong because the bowl system had been pretty good to college football. You know, whether we go to eight, time will tell. It isn't a foregone conclusion, but there's certainly a case to be made. And, you know, I think that we have 7 more years left on a media contract. And I think there'll be a continuing discussion about it, but I think we have to be thoughtful because there were a lot of compromises that went into it. And most of those compromises haven't gone away. They're just as valid as they were when we first put it in place.
To follow up on that, when you look at college wrestling and you've talked about the importance of a national dual championship, what would that look like? What is the ideal scenario in your mind? How many teams would be involved? Where would it be on the calendar? What would give us the best opportunity for growth?
Well, if I'm the benevolent dictator, I would probably have an early season that included maybe some individual tournaments like the Midlands that might start after the semester is over in the fall. and go through the holidays and maybe the early part of January, and then do an NCAA tournament that is a little earlier than the one we have now, so it isn't head to head with the men's basketball tournament like it is now. I mean, I've always thought that we really fought for some publicity and a profile that we should have had, because we were typically that first weekend of the men's basketball tournament is the NCAA tournament. And then, you know, after that, you know, during the months of March and April, do a significant dual meet competition, and then a dual meet tournament that would take maybe the last three weekends of April, and have maybe start out with 32 teams on college campuses, and then bring either the final eight together or maybe the final four together. Maybe you bring the final four together and you do a full round robin and everybody wrestles everybody and figure it out that way. Or maybe you just do it as a full elimination. I just think it would, the dual meet tournament would be a lot easier for casual fans to follow. They may not know everything there is to know about individual athletes, but they do know that they're a Hawkeye fan or a Cyclone fan or a Sooner fan or a Nittany Lion fan. And I think there could be a lot of energy. And I think it's probably a better television event than the NCAA individual tournament. And I wouldn't want the individual one to ever go away. And I wouldn't want there to not be a team champion crown there, but I think there could be another component to it that would be easier for fans to follow and maybe give us the opportunity to bring some people to wrestling that haven't been there before. And you know, you look at the success of UFC and some of the mixed martial arts things, it's at a time when boxing is making a resurgence, and I think that audience would also consume the sport of wrestling if it were presented to them properly.
Bob, when you lived in Iowa City, how often did you go home, pick up that Iowa City Press Citizen paper, and read an article about football or wrestling written by Andy Hamilton?
Lots of times. Lots of times. Andy's been a guy that has been very devoted to the sport of wrestling, and of course covered a lot of other stuff during the rest of the year, but always appreciative of anybody who really cares about wrestling.
Bob, we are appreciative of you for being on our podcast. A lot of great information there. Appreciate your candor and your insight about the sport and the FBS system. We talked about that a little bit, but thank you for being on the program, and thanks for being involved in the Gable Museum and a slew of other things that involve the great sport of wrestling.
Well, I'm very proud of my hometown and proud that the museum is there, and always happy to support, and not only to support the museum, but to support wrestling in general. And thanks for all you guys do to make it the great sport it is.
Well, and I will say this, you're a fine young lad.
Well, consider that I know where that came from. That warms my heart.
Yep. Well, that came from your coach, Bob Siddons, and thank you for being on the show. I'm sure we'll see you at wrestling events throughout the country.
I'll look forward to it. Thanks, guys.
All right. Thank you. That was Bob Bowlsby. A lot of information to soak in, digest, but all of it was really good content. And he gives you a look, Andy, at information that you're not going to get elsewhere, because he has a unique perspective. You've been around him a long time. I'd expect nothing less from a Bob Bowlsby interview.
That was awesome, wasn't it?
It was. Just, I picked up a lot of information. He hit on some points that we've tried to drive home, really talked about the importance of a dual meet championship. And when you hear him put it in that way, I don't know how we don't have this yet. It just makes so much sense across the board. It seems like we're getting there, but we always talk in these terms now. I hope we're not a decade down the road and still having these conversations. We do need to make this growth. We need to make this progress. Dual meet championships matter. Let's make it happen.
Absolutely. You think of what we watched Monday night with college football championship game. You think about what we'll see the last Monday in March or first Monday night in April, whatever the calendar falls on with the college basketball national championship and what those sports have going for them and the buildup to that. We're lacking that right now. We've got everything going throughout the season, and it really doesn't matter a whole lot until the end. And I mean, we kind of know how it's going to go right now at the end of the tournament, right?
I mean, we do. Yeah. I don't see any scenario at this point that excludes Penn State from being at the top. I mean, of course there's some things that can happen, but I don't know. I think history just says it's going to be Penn State at this point. You have four returning national champions and a host of other guys that are doing extremely well in the rankings. It's probably going to be Penn State. I think for the most part across the board, you can have a 95% prediction rate on which team will win the NCAA championship. I think from 08 to 2010, I think we knew it was going to be Iowa. I think there was a couple years in there, 06 being one. I think Oklahoma State and Minnesota were neck and neck, and 07 was probably neck and neck. But for the most part, you know which team's going to be at the top of the heap at the end. I think the national dual meet championship component, when you have maybe the Big Ten Conference, you get your automatic qualifier, but then you have a selection show. And I think people get excited about that because your team might be in the mix for a national dual meet championship. That really is exciting. And then it makes the guy that maybe is the 20th seed, you know, if he's going against the fifth, sixth, seventh guy in the nation, boy, his elevation, how much does he raise his game? Because he knows his team needs him to perform at a very high level. So that 7 minutes becomes so much more important. There's so many things, so many directions that make this unique, make it important for the sport. I just think that it's a direction that is almost a must at this point.
Well, think about the playoff right now. And granted, we're sitting here second week of January, and we could probably predict that in 51 weeks, Alabama and Clemson, or 49 weeks, Alabama and Clemson are going to be in the semifinals again. But there's a lot of interest throughout that regular season about which teams are going to be in the Final Four, which teams are going to make the playoff. And even, you know, through the first week of December and all throughout December, you got discussion, even after the first, the semifinals, was Notre Dame worthy? Should Georgia have been there? Then Georgia lays an egg in their bowl game. Well, maybe Georgia didn't deserve to be there, but there's so much discussion from right now that there will be through spring ball, and then we'll get into the summer and we'll start talking about it again. Then the games will begin again. And from the end of August until we get to this point, the first week of January, we're going to be talking about that playoff system and, you know, should there be eight teams? There's just so much discussion, so many discussion points about college football that are created because of the scenario that they've set up now.
Well, and to your point, you said this often. How often do we have a sport that is contested throughout the season predominantly with dual meets, and then we have an individual tournament that decides? And it's not apples to apples here, but what if you had a 162-game baseball season then said, oh, let's settle it with a home run derby? It's not exactly comparable, but the point is valid to a certain degree that you're not competing on the same level. So we do need something that is comparable.
Yeah, and then even what we talked about last week, it's scored the same way for dual meets. Scored one way for dual meets, and then it scored a completely different way for the national championship tournament.
Yeah. And then if you lose, you still get the same amount of points. You're rewarded for bonus points on the backside. So you get a half point for advancement, and then falls are still worth two. Why are you cutting the advancement in half, but not the major decisions, technical falls, and falls in half when you get on the consolation side?
We have a lot of things to work through as a sport, but, and I wrote this in my column for this week, I can't think of a period of more transformation that's ever occurred in college wrestling than the one that we're in the midst of right now. You think about it. The 3-point near fall is extinct in college wrestling. That had been part of the sport for decades. There was talk about the headgear going away. There's talk about 3-point takedowns, the edge of the mat rule that's come in. There's talk about, as we mentioned on last week's show, Mark Branch, you know, said that the hottest topic in the spring was overhauling dual and tournament scoring. It seems like the rules committee is more apt than ever before to dive in and put everything on the table. That they're going to look at things that, how can we promote the sport? How can we create more action and entertainment? And how can we simplify for the general sports fan?
And a couple things to consider as you put this seed into my head was just thinking about the progression. I'm not sure in the early stages of wrestling that maybe it was never meant to be a spectator sport. Maybe they viewed it as an interscholastic sport where it was more to develop young men and use it as a training tool. I don't know. I'd like to get into the logic, and then it kind of morphed into something else. And I think when Myron Roderick got on the scene and started promoting it, and then Gary Kirtlemeyer took it even higher, I've heard with the University of Iowa, before Gary Kirtlemeyer got there, when Dave McCuskey was the head wrestling coach, his view was, we don't really care about the fans. We just want this to be an athletic competition. And if fans show up, fine, but we're not here to promote the sport that way. It'd be interesting to go back. But we're at that point, and how many combat sports are there at this NCAA level? I think wrestling is the only one that's a one-on-one combat sport. And in that frame, we're doing pretty good for ourselves because there's not anything comparable to what we have. There's a lot of things that need to happen, a lot of tweaks, and we have a complicated legacy. But I think we just have enough data right now that says if we do these things, we're going to be a stronger sport long term.
Yeah, I think I've said this for years on, you know, even when David Mercatani and I were doing Weighing In, that we talked about some of the changes in the sport. And one of the things that I said is when you've got a guy like Bob Bowlsby, was willing to sit in on the Blue Ribbon Task Force, a guy as connected as he is, that's invested like he is in the sport of wrestling, and he's telling you that you need to do this as a sport to strengthen yourself for the long term, I think we need to listen. I think there are a lot of people with great ideas, like going to a second semester sport and all the things that Bob outlined in that interview. But we get to this discussion stage, right? I mean, we seem like we are perpetually stuck in the discussion phase. Like we've talked about in the past, like 20 years ago, 19 years ago, I go to my first NCAA championships in St. Louis the Wednesday before the tournament, the news conference before the tournament. Jay Robinson talked for about 10, 15 minutes about why we needed to get away from March Madness. And here we are. The tournament is still on the tournament starts on the Thursday, the same day that the NCAA basketball tournament starts.
Almost forever.
Yeah.
Since the beginning. It's always been this time frame.
Yeah.
A lot of great discussion points. We want to thank Bob Bowlsby for being on the program. As always, for Andrew Hamilton of TrackWrestling.com, I'm Kyle Klingman. You have been listening to On the Mat.
Is part of the Matt Talk Podcast Network. For more wrestling podcasts, head over to MattTalkOnline.com.